Hello again, this is Gerald Finney, Chief Counsel and Assistant Director of the Biblical Law Center. I am teaching on the concepts regarding separation of church and state. Right now I'm dealing with a very important subject, the Separatists and the Baptists in New England, in the New England colonies. There was a spiritual warfare that went on in the colonies that led to the adoption of the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, establishing the First Nation, the second government behind the government of the colony of Rhode Island, in history to have religious freedom as guaranteed by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution. My ultimate goal is to educate Christians and pastors, especially pastors. If we cannot get our churches straightened out, we definitely will never be able to get our nation straightened out. Unless churches educate themselves, put themselves solely under the headship of the Lord Jesus Christ, in other words, get rid of their incorporate 501c3 status, their legal entity status, which they may gain in other ways, unless they do that, it's hopeless for America. If we can't straighten our churches out, we will never be able to straighten America out. Of course, there are other heresies and problems that Bible-believing churches need to deal with, but this issue of church and state is very, very important. Now let me return to the history of the Separatists and the Baptists in New England. Attempts to gain religious freedom continued. The Warren Association sent Isaac Backus to the Continental Congress in 1774, where he met with an association of other Baptist churches from several adjacent colonies, which had elected a large committee to assist. They presented their appeal for religious liberty. John Adams and Samuel Adams, neither of whom was a friend to separation of church and state, falsely asserted that Massachusetts had only a very slender establishment, hardly to be called an establishment, that the general court was clear of blame and always there to hear complaints and grant reasonable help. While Mr. Backus was gone, the lie was spread that he had gone to Philadelphia to break the union of the colonies. All the time these happenings were going on, the issues were being debated in the newspapers. The Warren Association continued to publish to the public instances of persecution as well as to actively seek religious liberty from the government. The Warren Association presented a memorial on July 19, 1775, requesting religious liberty and pointing out the inconsistency of rebelling against England for taxing without representation while doing the same thing in the colonies. Ultimately, nothing came of this. In 1777, Mr. Backus prepared an address which was supported by a large number from various denominations urging religious liberty to the assembly which had been empowered to frame a new constitution, which was accomplished in 1780. The third article of the new constitution excluded all subordination of one religious sect to another, but imprisonment and confiscation of property from men who refused to acknowledge such subordination continued. In 1778, Mr. Backus wrote, "Government and Liberty Described and Ecclesiastical Tyranny Exposed." He quoted Charles Chauncey, and I quote, "We are in principle against all civil establishments in religion. It does not appear to us that God has entrusted the state with a right to make religious establishments. We claim no right to desire the interposition of the state to establish that mode of worship, church government, or discipline we apprehend is most agreeable to the mind of Christ. We desire no other liberty than to be left unrestrained in the exercise of our principles insofar as we are good members of society." Close quote. This, said Backus, was all the Baptists asked. Perhaps as a result of this tract, the General Assembly tried to conciliate the Baptists by appointing a Baptist minister to deliver the election sermon on May 1779. That minister, in his sermon, remained faithful to the principle of separation. Massachusetts began efforts to adopt a new constitution in 1777. The proposed constitution was defeated, but a new effort, which began in 1779, proved successful. John Adams worked against the Baptist position at the convention. Mr. Backus, although not a delegate, went to Boston to stand for Baptist principles during the Constitutional Convention. He lobbied, wrote newspaper articles, published new tracts, and informed his brethren of what was going on. Mr. Backus worked at the convention for a Bill of Rights. The first basic rights Mr. Backus listed were: All men are born equally free and independent and have certain natural, inherent, and unalienable rights, among which are the enjoying and defending life and liberty, acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and for using and obtaining happiness and safety. As God is the only worthy object of all religious worship, and nothing can be true religion but a voluntary obedience unto His revealed will, of which each rational soul has an equal right to judge for itself, every person has an unalienable right to act in all religious affairs according to the full persuasion of his own mind, where others are not injured thereby. And civil rulers are so far from having any right to empower any person or persons to judge for others in such affairs and to enforce their judgments with the sword, that their power ought to be exerted to protect all persons and societies within their jurisdiction from being injured or interrupted in the free enjoyment of his right under any pretense whatsoever. Bacchus' position, although seeking the same end, was from a different point of view than that of George Mason, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison. 3 years earlier, George Mason, with Jefferson's approval and Madison's amendments, had written a statement on religious freedom into the Bill of Rights in the Virginia Constitution. And let me quote that to you. Quote, "That religion, or the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it, can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence, and therefore all men are equally entitled to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience, and that it is the mutual duty of all to practice Christian forbearance, love, and charity towards each other." Bacchus' tone was that of a New Light pietist. Mason's that of an enlightened latitudinarian. The Virginian spoke of the Creator. Bacchus spoke of God. Mason stressed reason and duty. Bacchus stressed religious worship. Bacchus referred directly to God's revealed will and to the soul. Mason omitted any reference to them. The difference was obvious and fundamental. The Virginia separatists were interested in leaving the mind free to follow its own rational direction. The Massachusetts pietists believed that separation was necessary in order to leave the rational soul free to find true religion as expressed in the Bible, the revealed will of God. Implicit in both statements was a belief in God, in natural law, in man's ability to find them. But the deistic separationists of Virginia trusted entirely to man's reason and free will. The pietists insisted that only through the supernatural grace of God would men find the truth that is in Jesus Christ. Though both views were individualistic, the deistic was anthropocentric, the pietistic theocentric. In other words, the deistic man-centered, the pietistic God-centered. The humanistic view of Mason, Jefferson, and Madison, that man through his reason could successfully address all his problems, and the humanistic goal of the happiness of man were inherent in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the two greatest governing documents of any nation of any time in history, although they were blended with biblical principles. The goal of the glory of God was not in the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution. Again, the Constitution is the greatest governing document ever conceived by a nation. But the biblical principle of leaven, bad doctrine always corrupts the good, was proven again by the national experience to be true. To understand and address a problem, we must be willing to face all the facts head on. The Warren Association on September 13, 1780, published a remonstrance, authored by Mr. Bacchus, against Article 3 of that proposed Constitution, stating, among other things, that the provision therein requiring the majority of each parish the exclusive right of covenanting for the rest of religious teachers, thereby granting a power no man has a right to, and further stating that the legislature, by this article, are empowered to compel both civil and religious societies to make what they shall judge to be suitable provision for religious teachers in all cases where such provision shall not be made voluntarily. But support for ministry could only be through voluntary support, not coercion, which denied freedom of conscience. Bacchus and other Baptists did not object to the view that Massachusetts should remain a Christian commonwealth. piety, religion, and morality could only be maintained with the institution of the public worship of God and of public instructions in piety, religion, and morality were generally diffused throughout the community. Jefferson, Mason, and Madison, designing the creation of a secular state, not only opposed all such practices, but also objected to the use of chaplains in the Congress and armed forces, the authorization by the state of certain days of fasting, thanksgiving, and prayer, and the compulsory religious services in state universities. Jefferson explicitly stated that America was not and ought not to be a Christian country. Bacchus never qualified his belief in a Christian commonwealth. He consistently argued for a sweet harmony between church and state. It is readily granted, he wrote in 1784, that piety, religion, and morality are essentially necessary for the good order of civil society. The Baptists fought on. They took their case to the courts. Atterbury, Massachusetts, assessed a religious tax on everyone. Some members of a Baptist church in Atterbury refused to file a certificate and refused to pay the tax. The property of some was sold to pay the tax. Elijah Balcom, after being arrested, paid the tax under protest, then sued to test the constitutionality of Article 3. They won an initial victory in county court. However, the case was overturned 2 years later on appeal of the favorable trial court decision in the case of Cutter versus Frost. Cutter also held that only incorporated religious societies were entitled to legal recognition. Since most, if not all, of the Baptist churches in Massachusetts were unincorporated, they were not qualified for exemption. A lawyer advised Mr. Bacchus and the grievance committee to file the certificates, pay their taxes, and sue if the parish treasurer refused to turn the money over to their own pastor. The committee voted to follow this advice, Mr. Bacchus casting the lone negative vote. This was a reversal of the 1773 stand against giving of the certificates. The spirit of the times did not call for martyrdom and fanaticism. The other members of the committee were more interested in improving the status and respectability of their denomination. As a result, three cases were brought in three different courts, and the Baptists prevailed at trial court and on appeal. In other cases over the years, much time and expense were expended to get tax money earmarked for Baptist ministers. One case required 14 lawsuits before the town treasurer yielded the taxes. In some towns, when it was shown the Baptists would sue, the standing order ceased to argue the matter. Mr. Bacchus, being disappointed with his 12-year battle against certificates, turned his zeal to other outlets, to fighting the threat to Baptist doctrines. As new Baptist churches continued to be constituted and the number of Baptists continued to increase, the persecution continued in Connecticut. In 1784, Connecticut made a new law continuing the support of established ministers by taxation. However, another act exempted all persons from that tax who filed a certificate to the effect that they regularly attended and supported worship services in any type of gospel ministry. Mr. Bacchus said of this act, "Is not this a mark of the beast? Blood hath ever followed the support of worship by the sword of the magistrate. And how can any man keep himself unspotted from the world if he forces the world to support his worship?" Then in May 1791, Connecticut passed an addition to the ineffectual law of 1784, which held that no certificate could be legal until it was approbated by two justices of the peace, or only by one if there was no more in the town where the dissenter lived, and that such certificate was ineffective as to taxes granted before the certificate was lodged. However, after a remonstrance and petition were presented, the law was repealed in October 1791, and another law made to allow every man to give in his own certificate if he dissented from the ruling sect. The quest for religious freedom in Connecticut continued until 1818, when state support was withdrawn from the Congregationalist Church. I'm sure many listeners have never heard the facts that I'm giving you. I was deceived for many years by Christian revisionism. I was never told the facts that I'm giving you. These are historical facts. The relevance of these facts is obvious. It's obvious that we should know these facts, that we should understand these facts. That's why we're where we're at in America, is because Christians have not done their job right. I'm being blunt, but I'm just telling you the truth. I don't know how else to put it. Next week, I'll continue the study of the history of religious freedom in America. I will take up from here with the study of the movement of the Baptists from New England to the South. Great revivals accompanied that movement. From there, we'll go to Virginia, and then finally to the new nation, the United States of America. See you next week, same time, same place.